When social reformers set out to abolish inequality, are they doomed to fail? Is inequality an inevitable part of human society? In attempting to answer questions like these, historian David Christian looks at the big picture, not just conventional history, but big history, a field of study which examines human history against the backdrop of human evolution and natural history. Can this broader view give us a deeper understanding of events like the Russian Revolution? David Christian is the director of the Big History Institute at Macquarie University.
What is the central issue raised by the Russian Revolution? I think it's very clear. It's the issue of equality. Most human societies have been profoundly unequal. Is this necessary? Is it possible to create equal societies? The Russian Revolution, or the two revolutions, were the most aggressive attempt in the 20th century to create a more equal society. And let's agree straight away, I think most historians would, it failed. So the question of why it failed becomes immensely important in understanding something about human societies in general and our world. So let's look at the project of the Russian Revolution, the project, the egalitarian project, to create a world without class differences. Modern history begins really with the American and French revolutions, with these revolutionary attempts to abolish unfreedoms of various kinds. The Americans got rid of the tyranny of British colonialism, the French got rid of the tyranny of autocracy and feudalism, creating societies that claimed to be freer than ever before. But the socialists, 19th century socialists, argued that beneath the political freedoms, there's economic unfreedom. And that is the foundation of all of this. If people have different access to resources, they have different power, whatever their formal legal rights. And so they argued that the foundation of inequality is private property, the institution of private property, the institution that allows some people to accumulate vast resources while others get less and less resources. That's the key to unfreedom in the modern world. So liberation means abolishing that right. Here's how the Communist Manifesto puts it. The history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles. Freeman and slave, patrician and plebeian, lord and serf, guildmaster and journeyman, in a word, oppressor and oppressed, stood in constant opposition to one another, carried on an uninterrupted, now hidden, now open fight, a fight that each time ended either in a revolutionary reconstitution of society at large or in the common ruin of the contending classes. So this fight over inequality and property has been fundamental to human history, they argued. Now, what Marx added to this was a systematic analysis of capitalism and its weak spots, because he thought, if it's impossible to abolish inequality, let's not try. It's a waste of blood, time and effort. So let's analyse modern society very carefully and see if it's got some weak spots, see if we think it's possible. And he argued, yes, indeed it does. And that's why Marx spent his life writing not about socialism, but about capitalism, to analyse how the things works and how it might break down. So here's his analysis of capitalism. Two key things. First, its great strengths. He was an admirer of capitalism, as much as any modern economist, and its great strength was its capacity to generate staggering amounts of innovation, raise creativity, generate more and more wealth. In other words, to create the wealth that a more egalitarian society would use once it had redistributed it to make a good life for everyone. That was its great strength. Here's how he puts it in the Communist Manifesto. The bourgeoisie, during its rule of scarce 100 years, has created more massive and more colossal productive forces than have all preceding generations together. The subjection of nature's forces to man, machinery, application of chemistry to industry and agriculture, steam navigation, railways, electric telegraphs. This is written in 1848, remember, and so on and so on. What earlier century had even a presentiment that such productive forces slumbered in the lap of social labor? Capitalism can generate growth like no other society we've ever known of. The great weakness of capitalism, though, was that as it transformed society, creating this new, fantastically productive society, it simplified class conflict. What was happening as capitalism developed was that the capitalist class, the bourgeoisie, was getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and richer and richer and richer, and the proletariat, those without property, were getting larger and larger and larger, more and more impoverished, more and more desperate. And eventually, he argued, attitude, stretch this elastic far enough and the thing's going to snap. And so what capitalism is doing is creating its own grave diggers. Once that happens, once the system snaps, then we can use all the technology developed by capitalism to build and create a more equal society. And so here's the goal. Here's what you want to create. In place of the old bourgeois society with its classes and class antagonisms, we shall have an association in which the free development of each is the condition for the free development of all. And that society will be communal or communist, in the more familiar word. That's the goal. Now, this is the goal that, in principle, the Russian revolutionaries, the Bolsheviks, and many of their comrades tried to implement. The goal, the project, failed. Let me just give some very simple justifications for that claim. According to Walter Scheidel, whose book The Great Leveler, it's a wonderful history of equality and inequality in human society, I'll come back to. He writes, in 2015, the richest 62 persons on the planet owned as much private net wealth as the poorer half of humanity, over 3.5 billion. And a recent Oxfam report, based on data from Credit Suisse, argues that the richest 1% of people now own 50% of the world's wealth. That's the level of inequality we're talking about today. If, like me, you own a house in a big city without a mortgage, you shouldn't be too complacent about this, because you are part of the top 10% of all of this. And in Russia today, where this project was launched, Gini coefficients, which are very general measures of inequality, are over 40. That puts them as high as in the United States and other mature capitalist societies. So there are lots of other measures by which this project simply failed. So my question is, why did it fail? And I think this is a profound and deep question, because it's about the nature of human society, and it's about the odds of creating a human society that is more fair, that can give a better life for more people. So it's a profound and important question. And I'm going to analyze it at three scales, each of which I believe can illuminate the question as a whole. So the first scale is that of human history, a conventional historian scale. The second is the scale of human history, a scale of 200,000 years. What does this project look like in the trajectory of human history? And the third is the scale of the biosphere. That's a scale of 4 billion years. Is inequality something unique to our species? Does it appear in other species? Is it a property of the biosphere, not just of our species? Okay, scale one, standard historical explanations. I think what I say in the next part of this talk probably reflects a pretty broad consensus about why it went wrong. And for historians, there's an old Soviet joke, if you're going to experiment with this wonderful idea of socialism, it might be a good idea to start with Albania rather than the largest country in the world. It was a tired old Soviet joke, but I think there's a lot of truth in it. They tried it in the largest country in the world. So for historians, the first problem was that the revolution happened in Russia, not in mature capitalist societies, not in Germany, not in the UK, not in the Americas. And that meant that it lacked Marx's two crucial preconditions for a successful communist revolution. The first was high productivity, a highly industrialized society, lots of technology, high levels of technology, lots of wealth that could be redistributed. The second was a huge proletariat, a vast proletariat. Neither precondition existed in Russia. This was still a peasant society, by all sorts of measures, with a smallish industrial sector. So, why did this experiment happen in Russia rather than someone else? Why Russia? We could get very fancy about this, but let me suggest two key factors. First, I think recent research is suggesting that Russia was not quite as backward and stagnant as we often think. It was rather, it's a very rapidly developing capitalist society. It was developing very fast indeed. There are all sorts of measures of very interesting sort of entrepreneurial activities, interesting technologies. They made the best rifles in the world, but they weren't as cheap as American rifles, so they didn't sell as well. A flourishing capitalist society. Now, what that meant is huge stresses for peasants, for industrial workers, even for the elite of society. So think of Britain or Europe in the early 19th century. Early capitalism is very stressful. It's a period of rapid, stressful change. So the stresses were huge, and you've just seen a wonderful example in Eisenstein's battleship Potemkin. He captures cinematically a sense of the underlying tensions of the society. So huge stresses. But having said that, it's not clear that those stresses alone were sufficient to bring down the system. The second key reason why it happened in Russia was because of its political system. Russia was ruled by an autocracy. It had been for many centuries. And I think there are very good reasons for this. A highly militarized, disciplined, united elite that held together a vast country in a region with limited resources. That system had worked very well under colossal stress in many situations over the last few centuries. But the great weakness of autocracy is that at the very top, a lot depends on the individual. And in Russia, in the early 20th century, you had at the top of the system a politician who almost totally lacked political skills and political understanding. And not only that, unlike his father, who also lacked those skills, didn't listen to people who had them. So this is very dangerous. A period of stress, an autocratic system with a ruler who doesn't understand things. And the crucial trick he missed, I think, was he failed to hold together the elite, a disciplined elite. By World War I, many elite groups, businessmen, academics, scholars, scientists, entrepreneurs, generals, the military people, were politically liberal, but don't think they were Democrats. What they really wanted was a more active role in government. And during World War I, appalled at the incompetence of Russia's military performance, they kept saying, "Please, sire, appoint us. We actually know how to run things." And this was absolutely true. There's a very, very smart elite in Russia in this period, create a ministry of public confidence. Nicholas refused because he saw this as a threat to his power, so he appointed ministers during World War I who said what he wanted to hear and had no connections, no skill, none of the skills of old needed to run World War I. So when the crisis came, and it came in February 1917, instead of rallying around him, the elites abandoned him. The general said, "Sire, it's time to abdicate." The politicians backed them, so did the entrepreneurs, so did the entire Duma. And in an autocratic system, if you remove the capstone, the thing can shear from top to bottom. And that's what happened in 1917. The whole thing broke down. Now, I think actually there was the most likely possibility in 1917, given more competent leadership, was a sort of authoritarian capitalism with a decorative constitution, something a bit like what we have actually in Russia today under Putin. That didn't happen, largely because of Nicholas. The whole thing broke down. And that left really two possible outcomes for 1917 as the government breaks down. The most likely one was probably a reconsolidation of the old elites, creating a fairly right-wing, authoritarian system with a lot of experience, a lot of wealth, and so on. The other alternative was also fairly authoritarian. A democratic outcome was very unlikely, simply because of the degree of divisions in Russian society. And that was a left-wing authoritarian government representing or claiming to represent Russia's working classes. That's the outcome we actually got. And I think one of the reasons is simply the skill of those on the left. 1917, if you're a politician or a revolutionary, is the political equivalent of a rodeo, okay? It's incredibly violent, you need to think quickly, luck plays a huge role, and the left won. They not only got power, they maintained power during a brutal, vicious three-year civil war against right-wing coalitions that represent what might have been an alternative Russian government if a leader with the skills of Lenin had emerged on the right. In the 20s, they find themselves in charge of Russia. Russia is now more backward than it was in 1914. The proletariat's smaller, industry is less productive, and the party is highly authoritarian and now militarized after 3 years of a civil war. And they now have to build this socialist project. So what happens? Well, what happens is that eventually Stalin, they fall back on traditional authoritarian methods. to build up industry. They abolish private property. That's a great achievement, formally, from the point of view of socialism. But they create entirely new forms of inequality. They create a new ruling class, the nomenklatura, a sort of collective ruling class. And in camps, millions of people are living in conditions of slave labor. They created new and brutal forms of inequality. And that is the failure of the Soviet project. Now, the failure actually goes even deeper than I've suggested. Let me suggest three reasons, ways in which that's true. You might think that at least the Soviet Union was trying to build a more equal society, while the capitalist society is allowing inequality to get worse and worse and worse. Not so. As the work of the famous French economist Thomas Piketty has shown, actually, rates of inequality declined for much of the 20th century throughout the world, even in the mature capitalist societies. So rates of inequality are declining elsewhere as well as in the Soviet Union. Secondly, capitalism survived what were still fairly high levels of inequality because of something Marx didn't foresee. Its staggering rates of productivity meant that capitalism was creating resources on such an abundant scale that eventually capitalists, Henry Ford is a kind of iconic example, realized the way to find markets is to sell goods to your own workers. Now, this is a beautiful solution to the problems of capitalism, because to do that, you have to pay them more so they can buy your Ford car or whatever it is. So what there emerges in the 20th century is a consumer capitalism in which the proletariat is not getting poorer and poorer and poorer, but getting wealthier. This is not a revolutionary proletariat at all. Great for capitalism because it means that growth softens the tensions created by inequality. There's a lot of inequality, but those tensions are softened by growth. And finally, the Soviet planned economy failed to generate growth. It failed to innovate. There are so many reasons for this. But basically, enterprise managers had no incentive to innovate. Their main goal was to fulfill the plans. Innovation meant disrupting things for a year or two. There's no guarantee of success. So as Brezhnev once said, Soviet entrepreneurs shied away from innovation as the devil shies away from incense. And that's absolutely true. So innovation slowed after the early years. By the 1980s, they couldn't build decent rockets. So the military are very unhappy. They couldn't feed the towns with the living standards they expected. So it was the Soviet Union that finally broke down as a result of the tensions, amongst other things, caused by inequality. Now, that's a conventional analysis of what went wrong with the Soviet experiment. Now I'm going to shift to the next scale, to the scale of human history, and ask the same question, but at this larger scale. At the scale of human history, which is a scale of about 200,000 years, that's how long our species has been around, you can ask this deeper question. Is inequality something that's built into our nature as a species? Is inequality characteristic of all human societies? If not, where does it come from?
David Christian is the director of the Big History Institute at Macquarie University, and you can hear his alternative take on inequality by listening to the whole program. It was broadcast late last year as part of a suite of programs on the centenary of the Russian Revolution. The link is on the Big Ideas website.